Platinum Island Studio in downtown Manhattan, we made an I4I, Your Beef Is Mine's, featuring Nas and Raekwon, and Right Back At You, featuring Ray, Ghost, and Noid. There was an ill energy in the air, like, damn, everybody in this room is hot right now. The Infamous took off like a rocket before it was even released. The Shook Ones remix, Shook Ones Part 2, was the biggest song on the album. And then came Survival of the Fittest. While we were shooting the video for Survival of the Fittest, even though we'd signed to Steve Rifkin instead of him, Puffy pulled up on the hill in Queensbridge in a white stretch limo and made a cameo appearance out of nowhere, unannounced. Even Nas made a cameo in that video. That was how we convinced Noid to start rapping. He saw that we were really going somewhere. Noid used to kick great verses on the block and in the honeycomb, but he wasn't into rap. He just wanted to sell drugs. Noid ended up kicking some of the most memorable verses on that album. On Right Back At You with Ray and Ghost, people say that Noid killed it the most. Our singles and videos started getting major burn on radio and TV, so we were on fire and the album wasn't done yet. While we were wrapping up the last few songs in Hempstead, some strange white dude with long hair and a beard came walking through Queensbridge with a Bible in his hand. He walked up to random people asking, "Do you know Prodigy? I have to speak with him." People looked at this fool like he was a basket case. This white dude walked around the projects for hours, asking how he could find me. Finally, he walked up to my man Ops, who told him to go to Havoc's apartment, 3A. The dude knocked on Hav's door. Killer, Havoc's Uncle La, and Twin Gambino opened it. "Is Prodigy here?" the dude asked. "Fuck is you?" Killer said. "And what you want with P?" "I got a message for him," the white dude said. "Please get him, it's important." "What message? Who are you?" Killer asked. "The message is only for Prodigy. I've been sent to give it to him myself. It's very important," the white dude said. "Please go get him." Killer thought the kid was a lunatic, so he pulled a gun on him and pushed him down the staircase. Gambino had to stop Killer from hurting him. Then Gambino asked the dude, "What's the message? I'm going to tell Pete for you. He's not here right now." "I've been sent to tell Prodigy who he is and his purpose on this planet." The white dude started telling Twin bugged out stuff. "Prodigy is an angel, and people have written about him in the Book of Revelations. He's powerful and people want to kill him." "Who sent you?" Gambino asked. And who wants to kill P?" "God sent me," the white dude replied. "I won't reveal who he said wanted to kill me, but it sounded very crazy." Gambino and Killer kicked him out the building, and he continued to walk around the projects in search of me. When I came back to the hood the next day, I saw Ops outside, and he told me about the dude. I didn't believe Ops, but Twin and Killer confirmed it was true. Twin explained everything he was saying, and it was the weirdest shit I ever heard in my life of living. Our music was affecting people in all kinds of ways. People went nuts for Shook Ones and Survival of the Fittest. So I just figured the white dude was a Looney Tune and an early Mobb Deep fanatic. We were making groundbreaking hit records for the hood and quickly becoming the most elite rappers in the world, responsible for creating one of the best eras in hip-hop history, the 90s. Nas, Mobb Deep, Wu-Tang Clan, Biggie, and Jay-Z. A changing of the guard. The West Coast had been dominating rap before we came out. Death Row was the biggest thing in rap. But when 95 hit, that changed. Shit, we were all influenced by each other in one way or another. The West Coast inspired us to do better, and I'm sure we inspired them, so it was all good. Everything was going perfect. Just as we was completing the Infamous, gunshots. I was taking a cap nap late at night in Hav's crib when shots rang through Hav's open bedroom window. 15 minutes later, Killer rushed upstairs, drunk. with a set of Walkman speakers in one hand and my .22 revolver in the other. "Hide the gun," he said coolly, handing it to me. "What happened?" I asked. "I think I just murked somebody for his Walkman speakers," Killer said. "Wow, he just killed a dude over nothing," I thought. "Walkman speakers?" I tucked the gun away under a mess of balled up clothes and half dresser for the time being, and tried to figure out exactly what happened. From half's window, I could see the crime scene, police lights, yellow tapes, cops are everywhere, but they had no clue as to what happened either. All they had was a body. Killer was trying to calm down and figure out his next move. He definitely had to leave the hood. Hav walked into the crib within an hour, and Killer explained what happened. We stayed up all night talking about what he should do. Where to hide, how to flee the projects without the cops spotting them. I took Killer to lay low in my crib in Long Island until he can get down south to his people in North Carolina. The next day, Hav Moms found a gun in the dresser and gave it to the pastor at the church. She didn't know what had happened. She found a gun in the house, and the first thing that came to her mind was to give it to the church. Killer hid out in a hood in Hempstead called Terrace by the bus terminal, then skipped town. After we found out the cops were definitely looking for Killer, we made the song Temperatures Rising about the situation. "What up, Black? Hold your head wherever you at, on the float from the cops with wings on your back." The infamous went gold in 30 days, and we were off on another promo tour, this time across the entire East Coast, Midwest, West Coast, and Europe. We brought the whole crew with us. We were getting a lot of love on the East Coast, but out West in California and the UK, they were diehard Mobb Deep fans. You could tell by the intense looks on their faces as their heads bopped. On the east side, our friend Puff Daddy was turning his new company, Bad Boy, into a powerhouse. Biggie Smalls dropped his hit debut, Ready to Die. The Scarface twin loved Biggie. "I told you," he was hype. "I told you this nigga's hot." We were cool with Puff, even though he was mad at us for not signing with Bad Boy. He put us on the Big Mac tour with Biggie and another new rapper named Craig Mack, performing at big venues all across the East Coast and getting paid. The wildest night on that tour was at a club in Cleveland, Ohio, a real rowdy crowd. Our crew was always prepared for drama. Before the show that night, we had a big steak dinner and stole 3 steak knives. We would make weapons out of anything. We'd order room service and not take the fork and bend down the 2 prongs at each end, squeezing together the 2 prongs in the middle to make an ice pick. At the venues, I might have to poke somebody in their eye and neck. Fuck that. We performing in hoods all over America. Better safe than sorry. At showtime, Craig Mack opened up. Mobb Deep, then Biggie. But when Craig Mack took the stage to perform, somebody from the crowd jumped up and snatched the microphone from his hand before spraying mace in his face. Mac ran backstage, warning everybody, "Don't go out there. Don't go out there. Them niggas is crazy." Backstage, I overheard Biggie tell his manager to let him go on next instead of Mobb Deep so he can get the money and get out of there. Our crew just laughed and sat back to watch. Biggie and C's went on stage, and sure enough, 5 seconds later, they came tripping down the stairs, running out the club. Mace flooded the air. It was hard to breathe. People were running all over the place and fighting the police. Pandemonium. Them Ohio niggas wasn't playing. I guess they wanted to show us Ohio was gangster too. My man Rondo, a hustler from Queensbridge, and I pulled our knives out and made our way to the exit. We couldn't find our car or driver in the side alley, so we hopped into the van with Biggie and C's. That was the first time on that tour we really kicked it with each other. I had a copy of the infamous in my pocket, and I gave it to them. We played it on the way to the hotel while passing blunts, then got some groupies back at the hotel. For the remaining month of the tour, we'd get drunk and high together before and after all the shows. Next, it was off the tour on our own in California. We had 3 days off, so I chilled at home with Kiki. When it was time for me to bounce, she wanted me to leave my hoopty, the little nigga, with her. I thought about it for 10 minutes. All I could think about was her driving to see some other nigga in my car. Hell no. I told her no, and she was mad at me. The night before leaving town, I went to Long Island to smoke some angel dust and get drunk with my niggas. The next morning, I got up early and was weaving in and out of lanes on the Long Island Expressway, blasting Raekwon's Glaciers of Ice, flying through traffic. I tapped the back of another car, and little nigga did a 360 in the middle of the highway. Buses and 16-wheeler trucks was coming at me full speed, but the higher powers were on my side. My car spun around and landed safely on the shoulder of the road and smacked into a concrete wall. My little nigga was destroyed. Whoa. My hands were shaking. That was a close call. I didn't have a license or anything. I grabbed my bag and my boombox. The car radio didn't work because it was a hoopty. Snatched the plates and the stickers off the car as fast as I could and walked quickly to the next highway exit to catch a cab to the airport. It was definitely the dust and Raekwon's purple tape that had me want to drive extra fast. In the cab, all I could think about was Kiki asking to borrow the car while I was gone. Damn, I should have left it with her. Fuck it. Little nigga only cost me $1,000. I'll buy a new one when I get back from Cali. In California, Lyle had a West Coast office. A rep named Bigger B showed us all over Cali. I've been visiting Cali since I was a little kid with my grandmother. This time I got to see the real deal on the west side, from L.A. to the Bay, Sacramento, and San Jose. Bigger B was the man out there. He made sure the entire state was hip to Mobb Deep by the time we were done with that tour. After the West Coast promo tour, it felt good to be back home and finally have everybody recognizing us in the street, asking for autographs and telling us that they loved our music. But disappointment hit when we found out the D's caught Killer down south. They had his pager tapped. The D's had shown up at Carrie's crib in Long Island, where Killer had used the phone a few times. They traced the calls and came asking Carrie and his mother about his whereabouts, but they didn't say a word. Killer did about a year in Rikers Island when Havoc started getting word from the lawyer he hired for his brother's case that somebody from QB was snitching, but he didn't have a name yet, though. That summer, Raekwon dropped his solo album Only Built for Cuban Links, and to promote both Ray and Mobb Deep, Steve Rifkin invited 30 of the top DJs from all over the country to Long Island to play paintball with us. Rappers versus the record labels and the DJs. A video station called the Jukebox Network came to film. I didn't last more than 30 minutes before I got shot up and killed off the team. And yo, them paintballs hurt. Later that night, Steve surprised us by throwing us a small private after party at the Marriott in Long Island where all the DJs were staying. We were chilling on the couches talking with Ray and Ghost and other Wu-Tang members when Steve walked in and surprised us, presenting us with our gold plaque for the Infamous album. Wow, gold plaque. I really didn't give a fuck. I wanted money, not plaques. But it was definitely a great achievement. I was still staying at my grandmother's house sometime, so I just propped it on the floor against the wall. Method Man from Wu-Tang was also gearing up to drop his solo album that summer. A couple of weeks after the paintball game, Meth performed at the Jones Beach Greek Fest. Yo, that nigga ripped it. I was with Illa G, his boy Ant, Carrie from my block in Hempstead, and his boy Ali. We was super high and drunk. Walked around for a few hours, kicked it with some broads. Thousands of girls, yo. It started pouring rain, so we took it back to my crib for more blunts and liquor. I did a few lines of coke on the low in the bathroom. Nobody knew I was sniffing coke. I used to see my pops do it when I was young and always wanted to try it. I got addicted right away. It's a real nasty habit. If you watch the Shook Ones video, I was real coked up. You could see it in my eyes. I was sniffing about 5 or 6 grams a day, rolled up with my weed and in my cigarettes. The more I used, the more I needed to get high. Coke makes you hyper with quick blasts of energy. At parties in Queensbridge, some of the older gangsters would be in the bathroom doing lines. They pass it right over like, here you go, shorty, take it easy, nap. None of Havoc's boys was in the coke. If they found out, they probably would have punched me in my chest and told me, playing yourself, and tried to take it from me. The only thing they were into was getting high off of weed, getting drunk, getting pussy, and selling crack. Puffy signed a female R&B artist to Uptown MCA, Mary J. Blige, who had a few hits out. Real Love, What's the 411, and You Remind Me, and was celebrating her album release party at the Supper Club near Times Square. We shot our video for Give Up the Goods in that club. It's a nice looking place. Mary J. wanted Mobb Deep to perform. Havoc, Gotti, Trip, Ty, the twins and I all wore black Infamous t-shirts. As soon as we walked in the Supper Club, all eyes was on us, cause mostly everybody was dressed upscale. Mary J. stepped right to us. She thanked us for coming to perform, introduced us to her little brother, and asked if we wanted anything to drink. We told her Hennessy, so she got us a bottle and we chilled in the VIP. Mary J. introduced us to the stage, and we killed Shook Ones, Survival of the Fittest, and Give Up the Goods, while Mary and her girlfriends were wilding out in the front row. We kept the show short and got back to the party, which was packed with so many females, we didn't know where to start. Some girls with different color minks followed us to the projects in the white bands. We took them to the Honeycomb, and niggas ran the train on two of them. I took one of them to Pebble Beach and got some head. We call all Project Roots Pebble Beach, because they're lined with pebbles, and it just sounds better than, let's have sex on the roof. She didn't let me hit it. She said she wanted to be with me and didn't want me to think she was a hoe. I wasn't interested in being serious with nobody but Kiki anyway. Shorties used to be open to come to Queensbridge. They'd be mesmerized by the hood, asking where was Nas at. The next night, we had a show at the Velvet Room on 23rd Street by the West Side Highway. Kiki came. This was her first time coming to one of our shows. A limo picked 20 of us up from Queensbridge, and we all wore Carhartt suits, black, brown, gray, navy blue, and forest green. I had a pint of E&J in my pocket to drink with Kiki after the show. I told her to hold it for me until we were done on stage. When we finished performing, I asked her for the bottle E&J, and she laughed, passing me an empty bottle. This girl drank the whole damn bottle, Dolo. I couldn't believe it. E&J is strong. Oh, well. The crew got back in the limo, and we rolled back to the hood. After everybody got out, I told the limo driver to drop Kiki and me off in Corona at her crib. But Havoc wanted to take the limo to his girl's crib in Astoria. We started arguing. Fuck it, I said. Kiki and I got out and walked to Queens Plaza to catch the train in the damn blizzard. As the limo pulled away, I picked up a bottle off the street and threw it, trying to break the back window, but I missed. I was pissed off that Havoc couldn't just drop us off. On the train, Kiki had her face in her bubble goose collar. It was cold, but her face was in there a little too long. I asked if she was okay. Then I saw her shoulders jumping like she was throwing up. This girl threw up in her coat, but she was too embarrassed to throw up in front of me. I told her she was crazy, but it was okay. Stumbling drunk, I held her up on the walk home from the train station. Luckily, her mom's wasn't home. I helped her get undressed, put her in the shower, and then fell out until late the next afternoon. I woke up and bounced back to Queensbridge because we had another show in the city for that night. Onyx was shooting a video at Irving Plaza, Union Square, in Manhattan. They wanted Mobb Deep to do a cameo. Chilling outside with the twins and a few of our boys between the scenes, Irving Plaza was right across the street from my old summer school, Washington Irving, This rapper named Keith Murray walked up and asked if I was taking shots at him on the intermission skit on the Infamous, when I vented all my frustration for my first album flopping. Sick with my mouth, I said, "Nigga, if the shoe fits." This bitch ass nigga just walked away from me and never said anything else. Can you believe that? If you listen to the skit, I didn't say any names or directed at anyone in particular. And no, yeah, so all them rap ass niggas with your half ass rhymes, talk about how much you get high, how much weed you smoke, and that crazy space shit that don't even make no sense. Don't ever speak to me when you see me, word. So, if someone thinks that skit is towards them, he must have some insecurity and feel that way about himself. Fucking punks. A new club opened up on the West Side Highway in Manhattan called The Tunnel. And oh my God, Jesus Christ, we would be in that spot every Sunday like church. Funkmaster Flex DJed along with his fellin' Big Cap. This was the mecca of all clubs, the best club that ever opened in America. Capacity 4,000, co-ed bathrooms. It was our generation, Studio 54. We ran through the tunnel like we owned it. This dude named Chris Lighty, a well-known manager and party promoter, ran the door. If you weren't cool with him, you waited outside for hours upon hours and paid top dollar to get in. Chris managed the Jungle Brothers, Q-Tip, and LL Cool J. He let all 40 of us in without paying. We got so comfortable with him that one night I pulled him to the side and gave him a gun to sneak in. He did it. One gun became two, two became three, and the next thing you know, I was handing him book bags full of knives, shanks, screwdrivers, guns, plus other sharp and blunt objects. Chris handed the bags off to me in the bathroom, and I passed the tools out to the boys. Try to understand. Number one, we're famous. And number two, every hood in the tri-state area was in that club, and it was dangerous. We never started trouble, but just imagine how we could finish it. Chris was a corporate dude who dressed in hoodies, jeans, and Timberlands, and came up working with Def Jam, practically raised in the industry by Russell Simmons. One cold night, on our way inside the tunnel, Havoc and I pulled Chris to the side and asked him to manage us, since he had so much experience in the business. A smile spread across his face. "Hell yeah," he said. "I'll do that." We walked into the jam-packed tunnel one night with a crew of 50, heading toward our favorite spot, the side of the bar opposite the exit. Yemi led the pack, pushing people out our way. "Oh shit, that's Mobb Deep." We saw like 50 other niggas walking towards us, pushing people out the way too. It was Wu-Tang Clan, with a sweaty, shirtless, Old Dirty Bastard leading the pack. "Prodigy?" Old Dirty said, looking at me. "Oh shit, come here, man." He grabbed and hugged me mad tight, getting his sweat all over me. Nasty. "I love you, Pete," ODB said. Kissed my cheek and walked away with his crew. Every time Funkmaster Flex played Nas or Mobb Deep, we lost control, slam dancing, tossing girls in the air, spilling drinks on ourselves. Chris Lighty pulled me to the side one night, knowing he just gave me a small armory of weapons. "Please don't kill anybody in here," he said. "They have cameras all over the place now." "Don't worry. If we do something, we're going to do it right," I assured him. Kiki always wanted to come out with me, but the tunnel was just too wild. We went for sex and war and to promote Mobb Deep. Co-ed bathrooms on the second floor had about 10 stalls and was easy to have sex inside of them. I think Money No was the only one of us that did that. Now Shame, one of Puff's hitman producers from Cabrera Heights, Queens, and his boys had this big idea of renting a yacht and sailing around Manhattan to celebrate Mobb Deep going gold. It sounded real high class, so we agreed. They'd make all the money from the ticket sales, and we'd enjoy a yacht party with free drinks. They promoted it at beauty shops, all over Queens, Manhattan, and a lot of ladies were talking about it in the street. My lady Kiki had gotten close with my boy Stobo's girlfriend, Fawn. They found out about the yacht party and wanted to come. But we weren't planning on bringing them. We wanted to stunt like single men for the night. It was my time to shine. I didn't want my girl around. The day of the party, I chilled with Kiki all afternoon. My plan was to bounce on her around party time. I felt bad because she was picking out her outfit all excited. "I'm coming with you to that party," she said. Around 6 p.m., she was in the bathroom taking a shower when I snuck out. I picked my cousin up from flushing, and we headed to the boat dock. Yes, we both dissed our girls, and we were ready to have the night of our lives. When we pulled up to the dock, I couldn't believe it. Kiki and Fawn were already there waiting. They'd taken a cab and somehow made it there before us. Fuck! I was mad as hell. How did they know where to go? It felt like I was going to the party with my moms. There were so many chicks on that yacht. You always see the best ones when you with your girl. Havoc and my QB niggas were making fun of me because they were free to do what they wanted while Stobo and I were the only two dickheads with our girls. I could have flipped on Kiki, started an argument before we got on the boat so she would go home, I thought. Fuck it. The yacht took off around 7 p.m. DJ Clue was spinning. And even though my girl was there, I had crazy fun drinking overproof rum, open bar all night. As the yacht circled Manhattan, Havoc and I snuck off to the bathroom and do some lines of coke. Toward the end of the night, Cormega wanted to get a rap session going, so we told Clue to play some instrumentals. We ripped it. Cormega, Havoc, Trip, Noid, Capone, Tragedy, and some niggas from Jamaica who were down with the dudes who threw the party for us. There was already animosity between Southside Jamaica and QB from back in the day. Mega and I grabbed the mic first. The dudes from Jamaica spit their rhymes, and the battle began. Tension filled the air as the session became a battle between Jamaica and QB. Everybody was drunk from the free liquor, arguing over who got next on the mic as the yacht pulled into the dock. "Back up!" three security guards ordered as everyone moved towards the exit. "Let the boat fully dock. It has to be tied to the pier before you can get off safely." But instead of waiting for it to dock, a few QB niggas tried to hop off early. My man Ice went first. A security guard started spraying mace in my man's face. Ice knocked him down, and it was on after that. An all-out brawl. Through all the commotion, Kiki and I lost each other, so I hopped off right behind Ice, Money No, Ty Nitty, Scarface Twin, and Capone to wait for her on the pier. A guy was standing at the top of the steps that we were running up to make it into the parking lot. Capone walked straight up to the dude and cut him across his face for no reason with a little Gemstar box cutter razor. Nitty and Money No dropped a giant flower pot on his head and kicked him into the Hudson River. The kid's boys came running off the boat straight up the pond and jumped him. Twin Gambino started letting off shots, and everyone on the pier was ducking, running, and hiding. People getting tossed into the water. I pulled my orange box cutter out of my pocket and started searching for Kiki. I didn't see Kiki anywhere. Maybe she stayed on the boat until things calmed down, I hope. I watched person after person until everyone was off the boat. When I turned around, Twin was swinging a long metal pole, cracking people in the head. They were dropping. I walked to the parking lot to see if Kiki was already at the car. And sure enough, she was sitting on the trunk of Little Nigga Part 2, waiting and watching. She had a look on her face like she'd been there for hours.